Regen Advisory Committee meeting. I'm Gary Nielsen. I'm the RAC chair. We'll start over here on the left and have these guys introduce themselves and what position they represent.
My name is Matt Clark, and I represent Sportsman.
I'm Mike Gates. I'm with the BLM and Fillmore, film manager.
Carl Hurst, I'm a Sportsman rep.
Chris Marvel, at large.
Richard Hansen, at large.
Larry Fitzgerald, agricultural.
Tim Fair, at large.
Sarah Flinders, representing the Forest Service.
Chris Schmitz, non-consumptive.
And Dan Potts, non-consumptive. We have two other members, George Holmes and Jay Price, that will excuse tonight. They have other business. A couple of things, you know, for those of you who have been to these meetings before, it's a public forum that allows you to express your opinions. We'll encourage you to do that. We could consider your ideas and the reports, and we'll report them to the Wildlife Board when the time comes. We have two new individuals over here, Jenny Zachary Fawcett and Lisa Graham, are going to assist us tonight, keeping the notes and the minutes, and you could help us a great deal by when you step to the mic, state your name, who you represent, or if you're representing yourself, state so. Hopefully you picked up an agenda over there by the table. There's also comment cards. They look like these. As far as a matter of procedure goes, for each presentation, somebody from the division will typically make a 10 or 15 minute presentation and talk about the ideas and the proposals. At the end of each presentation, I'll ask the RAC committee if there are any questions, give them the opportunity to further that with some questions. At that point, I will ask the audience if they have any questions, and at that point, you'll have the chance to ask questions or look for points of clarification to help you understand the position of the division and what they're proposing. It's not the time to ask to state your opinion and stuff, however. So at the close of the question period, we'll open it up to a comment period where you'll be asked for public comments. This is the point in time where you get a chance to stand up and state your opinion, what you feel, what you think, what you desire to see, or what you think would be best. This is a point where if you have those comment cards filled out, I will just go through that. I will call you up to the mic and give you the opportunity to express your opinions. But I need you to please state your name and the group you're representing. After all the public comments been received, we'll close the public comment period and we'll bring it back to the RAC for further deliberation. We'll also make recommendations and motions and vote on the subject. We often have individuals who want to address the RAC as individuals, you know, their personal thoughts, and we would allow you a maximum of 3 minutes when you do that. If you're speaking for an organization, you'll have a maximum of 5 minutes. We strongly urge you to make, when you're making comments, to listen to those that have commented before you. And if somebody's already said exactly what you're going to say, give somebody else a chance to speak to the topic. We also need you to do one thing. As I'll read your names and ask for your comments or your questions, please write legibly so I can tell what it says. I won't embarrass you or me. Anyway, okay. He's the kid. Yeah. Okay. It's all right. All right. We'll begin our meeting. Have you all had a chance to look over the agenda and the minutes from the previous meeting? I'll entertain a motion to accept that. Timothy? Okay. So motion by Timothy?
Move to accept.
What?
Move to accept.
Okay, Chris seconds it. Or Matt, sorry. Motion's been moved and seconded. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Okay. We just had Wildlife Board meeting today. There were some relatively interesting things I'm going to report to you on their voting of the things we talked about at the last RAC meeting. Went through the fishing guidebook had good thorough explanation of all the ins and outs of the program and what's happening with it and the direction it's headed. They basically passed the division's proposal unanimously. They did the same thing with the least chub refuge populations, which, you know, is a good idea to get some brood stock somewhere so we can just keep some going in case we have problems in some places. A lot of good things about the particular fish, the least chub, they eat mosquitoes, and I'm a big fan of that. The other thing that they talked about, which was really quite interesting, is they have some action items, some things that they're working on. They talked about they're thinking about Monroe stuff. They're talking about possibly whether the spike hunt's affecting the herd health down there. They also have been doing some other stuff, and I'll let John make your report. Sorry, I started doing that. Okay, we'll turn the time to John.
Okay. We have quite a lengthy agenda, so I'm going to be brief here. And go through the various programs that we have in the central region and some of the major activities that are taking place. We were the recipients of portions of the 11,000 pheasants that will be released during the pheasant hunt. And the feedback that we've received on the first batch that were released prior to last weekend was pretty positive. Those releases will continue this week and next. And all of the areas that are going to be stocked with these roosters are on our website. So they're wildlife management areas, and hopefully people will take advantage of that. We did have a second transplant of Rocky Mountain goats to the Mount Nebo unit. These came from Willard Peak. I believe it was 10 additional ones, so there was 20 total, and the total number is like 68 that we have on the unit right now. So the Nebo unit got quite a boost as far as its mountain goat herd this year. The Highland City urban deer control hunt has not made the news, so I don't need to talk about that. They haven't taken as many deer as they'd hoped. But not making the news on an urban deer hunt is what we're shooting for. The urban wildlife management plan that we're working on as a region is still in the works. We do have a new program that Scott McFarlane is running out of the Salt Lake office in the northern and central region. Rod Nielsen has taken a position with that program to give a little special emphasis on coming up with the strategies for dealing with urban deer in some of our cities where a lot of deer are getting hit, a lot of deer are causing damage to landscaping, and they don't really fall under the category of a legal responsibility that we have. But definitely they are protected wildlife, and we need to come up with ways to help cities manage those so they don't cause problems. While we're talking about Rod, he was nominated and received our Regional Employee of the Year Award, and then you stole him. You bummer, you know. And he's still with us. And we certainly appreciate all that Rod has done. Know he'll do well in his new job, and he'll continue to work for both of us. Okay, in our habitat section, we've got a pinyon juniper chaining project underway. These are actually green trees that are going down in the Dairy Fork Wildlife Management Area. Of course, the purpose is to increase the forage available for those deer and elk in the winter. We have added emphasis being placed on some upland game projects in the region this year. We're establishing food plots at our Car Fork Wildlife Management Area, our Nephi Game Farm, and the Santa Fe WMAs. So some of that's for doves, some of it's for pheasants, but we're trying to do what we can to increase habitat on our upland game areas. We also are in our habitat section, we're working on seeding the patch fire, which is out on the south end of the Okers. Stansbury, sorry. And that's a 12,000 acre seeding, and they'll actually be chaining 7,000 acres of that to cover the seed. In our aquatic section, we finished some electroshocking on Diamond Fork and Sixth Water. As Gary mentioned, the board approved the establishment of a refuge population of Lee's Chub in a private pond near Fairview. They also approved to raise the possession limit to twice the daily bag, except for Strawberry and Flaming Gorge. First phase of the Main Creek Restoration Project has been completed. That's a stream restoration effort involving some private landowners up in the area of Wallsburg. A lot of partnership involved with that in terms of the Natural Resource Conservation Service and several other groups. And I can't not say, if I can say that, fall fishing is very good right now, and people need to get out and fish. So we're plugging fishing. When it's good, you need to get out there. Conservation outreach, our Hunter Ed Plus program, it's still a pilot program in this region, and it involves taking new shooters through NRA basic shotgun shooting course at the local gun clubs that have passed their hunter education, and also taking those new shooters out on mentored hunts at local CHAs, commercial hunting areas. And we were able to provide that opportunity to a little over 150. And it's not a youth program. You'd be surprised how many in their 20s and 30s have never shot a shotgun, never hunted pheasants, that really would like to do so. They are ready to go. They've got wheels. They've got money. They can do it. And hopefully they'll take some of these younger kids with them. So that's a program that's just going on in this region. Hopefully we can get it going statewide someday. The outreach section is also in the process of developing this new wildlife recreation program that takes in shooting sports, mentored hunting, fishing events, hunter education. And again, the purpose is to of the program is to increase participation in hunting and fishing, deal with hunter recruitment, fishing recruitment, and retention, which is partially why we're releasing pheasants, trying to keep people interested in upland game hunting. In our law enforcement section, we are looking at winter range patrols to curtail poaching on critical mule deer winter ranges, and that is an activity that will take a lot of our officers' time this winter. If there are any questions, we can take them. If not, we can move on.
All right. As you get ready and get these comment cards filled out or question cards, just bring them up and we'll put them in the agenda area where they go. Our first item is an action item. It's the Bucks and Bulls Once in a Lifetime Permit Recommendations and Rule and the Amendment for 2014. We have Justin Shannon, the Wildlife Program Coordinator, who will make the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Shannon, and tonight I'm going to present the Bucks, Bulls, Once-in-a-Lifetime season dates and hunt structures and talk about some rule changes and deer transplants as well. So to begin, looking at deer hunt recommendations for next fall's deer hunt, essentially what we did is just move every general season deer hunt up one day, and this will be a common theme throughout the presentation. So your archery hunt is still 28 days, starting August 16th and going through September 12th. Muzzleloader, September 24th through October 2nd. And the Any Weapon Deer Hunt is still that third weekend in October, October 18th through the 26th. For elk, the six general season hunt dates we have, again, moving the date one day forward. For archery spike hunting, August 16th through September 5th. And for archery any bull, same dates except for it ends September 12th. For the Any Weapon, it's that first Saturday in October, October 4th through the 16th. Muzzleloader, the dates recommended are October 29th through November 6th. Youth Any Bull, September 13th through the 21st. And the Late Youth Any Bull will be November 29th through January 15th. How I'd like to format this is talk about those issues that are affected at the statewide level, and then get site-specific and individual regions and talk about issues there. So any recommendation that has statewide implications we'll talk about now. What we'd like to recommend is updating Rule 657-5, which is the big game rule. And the goal with this is to change some definitions. Any person 17 years of age or younger on July 31st would qualify as a youth. This date was chosen because essentially we don't have any big game or small game or waterfowl hunts going on at this time. And in the future, what we'd like to do is come back to the RACs with the recommendation that standardizes all of our rules. And so when you look at the definition of youth, it's not one thing for waterfowl and one thing for upland game and one for big game. It's all one definition. Tonight, we are only updating this for big game, and we'll come back with more. So if you pass the recommendation, this only applies to big game tonight, but our intent is to come back. Next, we'd like to recommend adding an addendum to the statewide deer plan that allows for mule deer transplants and also lists potential release sites. I provided a table and a map to go over these, and these are only release sites. We can take deer from anywhere in the state if we so choose, but these are areas that we would put these deer if we have them in hand. So the units would be Box Elder, 9 Mile, Elk Ridge, Current Creek, West Desert West, Southwest Desert, Oak Creek, Pavant, and Mountain Dutton. And these areas were chosen because they're off the Wasatch Front. We don't want to add more problems to urban deer issues. We feel like there's ranges here that have winter range that just doesn't have the deer densities that we think they could hold. And historically, there's portions of these units that held a lot more deer than they currently do. And the idea behind deer transplants, I'm sure it'll come up and have discussion, so I think I'll take the time to say it now. It's really a twofold process. The reason we're proposing transplanting deer is we have some areas in the state where lethal removal may not be socially acceptable anymore. Antelope Island would be a good example where we were overpopulated with deer, and we're very limited in our tools to get back down to objective, and so we'd be solving one problem in a localized area. Another component would be bolstering populations. So they're two different issues, and that's where these release sites would serve as areas that we could augment existing populations. Another recommendation, it was brought up a little bit earlier. In May 2013, the Southern Region was given an action item, and they were specifically asked to look at the Monroe unit to determine if it required a different hunt strategy. And so in October, the Southern Region went and they met with sportsmen down in Richfield, and there were a lot of concerns about spike harvest on the unit. And at the meeting, there were three options that were discussed. One was to eliminate spike hunting altogether for the entire unit. Another was to eliminate spike hunting only for the any weapon portion of the hunt. And then always the option is to stay status quo. This was addressed at the Wildlife Board meeting today. The Southern Region came and gave a report on it. And tonight and throughout the RAC process, our agency is recommending to eliminate the any weapon spike elk hunt on the Monroe until the next statewide elk plan is approved, so essentially for 2 years. And that will allow us to do a number of things. One, it can help us look at how to better address the elk complex on that unit. If you're not familiar with the unit, you have what what we call a metapopulation of elk, which is just elk that are interchanging from one mountain range to another. Yet what we're struggling with is we carve out a portion of that and say we're going to manage these elk. Well, sometimes the elk are there, sometimes they're not. And so it'll give us time to address, do we want to manage that at a larger scale? Look at access, look at things like that, look at the age objectives, different things. Moving forward, another thing we're recommending is allowing archery hunting of big game on select WMAs. These are our waterfowl management areas. These ones include Bicknell Bottoms, Browns Park, Clear Lake, Desert Lake, Locomotive Springs, and Redmond. And the idea here is these are division-owned properties that have deer and pronghorn on them in some cases, and they're closed to big game hunting because of, in the past it was always feared that these are only managed for waterfowl. But with our archery seasons occurring before the waterfowl hunts even start, we thought we could provide a little bit more opportunity for our big game hunters. Lastly, on the statewide level, what we're recommending is altering Rule 657-5 to allow for the use of crossbows, draw locks, and magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders during the any weapon hunts only. We're also recommending altering Rule 657-12 to align with these changes, and that rule just deals with muzzleloaders and crossbows and different things like that. So the two are related. While we have that rule open, we want to recommend updating definitions and other more minor portions of the rule. Some example would be deleting the definition of highway. It's defined, but it's never used in the rule. Resident, it's redundant. It's already spelled out in code. And terms like valid application, which we don't even use anymore. So things like that, just some house cleaning. And we also want to provide definitions and minimum requirements for crossbows and draw locks. Okay, moving on to the southern region. We're recommending modifying the Pine Valley, Virgin River, Bighorn Sheep boundary to be consistent with the deer, elk, and pronghorn unit boundaries. We're also recommending modifying the Panguitch Lake pronghorn boundary to account for an expanding pronghorn population. And then also we're recommending modifying the Mount Dutton and slash Ponsagat and then the Parker Mountain pronghorn boundaries to avoid overharvest of the Johns Valley herd. Essentially what you have is, this one's unique, you have these two areas, the Dutton and the Ponsagat, and then the Parker Mountain. And in between them, you have a smaller population of pronghorn in Johns Valley. And right now, that's in the boundary of the Parker Mountain, which we have a lot of permits for. And so we're going to carve it out of that and put it in the Mount Dutton portion so that we reduce the ability of that area being impacted with hunting. It makes more sense with the amount of permits that we issue. So, for the southeast region, we're recommending splitting the 9-mile Range Creek Bighorn Sheep hunt into an early and a late hunt. Each hunt will be roughly 15 days in November. This hunt, it has limited access. There's really only one or two good spots to get on the unit, but it has the most permits in the state. So we have potentially 20 Bighorn Sheep hunters all taking the same road in and out on opening morning. So we just wanted to break that up over time. The northern region, we recommend modifying the season dates on the Grouse Creek Limited Entry Elk Hunt from September 13th to the 21st and October 4th to the 28th. We also want to include an archery and muzzleloader season to increase bull harvest in that portion of the state. And we're also recommending combining units 2, 3, and 4, the Cache, Ogden, Morgan, South Rich, for pronghorn hunting. And this is so if pronghorns stay on private lands that in some of these units, there's available pronghorn in others. Okay, for the northeast region, we recommend expanding the boundary for the Uinta Basin Extended Archery Deer and Elk Hunt to target resident big game living in low-elevation agricultural lands. There's a lot of depredation that's occurring, and this is a way to get on top of some elk densities and kill some deer that are causing some problems. We recommend creating a new bison hunt on the Book Cliffs, and we also recommend splitting the Book Cliffs limited entry deer hunt into a north and south unit during the any weapon hunt. And this is to address buck to doe ratio discrepancies between the north and south portion of that unit. Okay, for the central region, we recommend removing bull elk from the San Pete Valley extended archery elk hunt. We recommend adding a Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep hunt for units 16A and 17A, which is essentially Mount Tippinogus, Rock Canyon, and Mount Nebo. Have all those units be combined into one for bighorn hunting. And then we recommend combining the Wasatch Mountains, the Box Elder Peak, Lone Peak, and Tippinogus units into one unit for mountain goat hunting. Some key dates to keep in mind and for your consideration tonight. The big game draw for bucks, bulls, once in a lifetime, and dedicated hunter applicants as well, will be from January 30th to March 6th. If you just want to apply for bonus or preference points, that date is extended to March 20th, and all these results will be posted by May 30th. For lifetime license hunters, these holders will automatically be assigned the unit they had the previous year. If changes are desired, those need to be submitted by March 6th. And those that did not hunt in 2013 and failed to choose a unit by the deadline, they can obtain leftover permits if they're available. Some key dates for our hunters with disabilities. I won't go into every one of them unless there's a specific question, but essentially what we've tried to do is allow for 5 days pre or post hunt to those hunters that have disability, give them a little more of a chance. And with that, thank you.
Justin, are there any questions from the rep?
Yeah, Danny. The bison hunt, how many animals are we planning on putting down?
You know, those permits will be recommended in the spring, but it'll be less than 10. It's just a handful. It's just to get that hunt established. Yeah.
Chris.
So, Justin, quick question. With the mule deer transplant locations, mm-hmm. I didn't see any sort of plan for any transplants. So today, are we just looking at simply voting or approving the locations? Is that simply what your proposal is today?
Exactly, Chris. So what it is according to code, if we're going to transplant wildlife, they need to occur in a plan, which is why we're doing an addendum to the plan. We have to provide release sites, which is what we're doing now, and it has to go through the public process. And so we're just kind of laying that foundation. And so later on in the year or next year, whenever the time comes that we transplant deer, and I think we will, it's an effort to be very transparent about where we're going to take these things and what we want to do with them. And so it really is just laying that foundation. We didn't want to get them in hand and say, well, what county would want to take them, or what, so this is just thinking through that.
Brian, that makes sense, and I think, maybe it's a discussion we can have down the road, but I think the concern is, there's obviously a transplant that's happened. We're in the middle of that, we're 6 months into it, and I think, the cost of doing that, and I know in this case, SFW is front of the money, but, the public would be very concerned about the cost benefit there, and how much is it costing us to do that, opposed compared to what the benefit is there. But perhaps that's a discussion that can be had later. But I think obviously, yes, your intent is to put together some plans to do that.
And cost has come up a lot with this. On does it cost as much for to trap deer as it does other big game? And mm-hmm. The reality is it depends, and I think in some cases it's going to be a lot less. If we use a drop net, that's very minimal, and you can do that with deer in the winter. You can do clover traps. There's other methods to do it. And even if you had a contract for 100 deer with a helicopter, because it's so quick, it is a lot less money. So, but those are good questions to ask. Is this going to be worth it? And this is a door that our agency wants to open up and see if this can be an effective management tool for us. And there's a lot of unknowns. I'll give you that, but it's something we want to try.
Sure. Do you know off the top of your head what the current mortality rate is on the existing study that's going on?
Yeah, I always preface it by saying that it's really premature and preliminary, but then it doesn't matter because I say a number and people just run with it, so I guess we'll do it again. But it is premature to look at this. We haven't even been a year, but of the 102 translocated deer that they've moved, 44 have died. So right now we're probably 50 to 60% survival, and how we finish up the year and how we do next year is still to be determined, but those are the data.
But we haven't had a winner on that transplant yet, right? So we're almost 50% haven't had a winner on it, is that right?
Well, yeah. For mule deer, the most difficult time of year for them would be March and April and May, kind of that transition period, because their reserves are used up, they're giving birth. So I would argue that we've already been through the toughest time of year for them, but they do have another winter coming. And so, since January, the toughest time of year for them would be April, and we're past that. So,
as a comparison, do you know what the mortality rate is on resident deer in that same?
Yeah, I think of the 50 deer they radio collared, they've only lost 5 to my knowledge. So it is, it's better, yeah.
Richard.
Yeah, on the Brook Cliffs, you want to split that unit into half. Can you tell us what the buck-doe ratios are, north versus south?
Yeah, I think on the... let's see, I think I have that here. On the south we're about 37, I'm sorry. And on the north, I can't remember what that was. I didn't manage that unit, but I think they were about 27. Okay. So we always were 10 to 12 bucks per 100 does more than them on the south compared to the north. And it made for an interesting dynamic. And I don't know if this rack heard it, but I know other racks throughout the state, people would come and discuss this issue. And the guys on the north up in Vernal that hunt that area, they'd say, our quality's going down, we need to cut tags. And on the south, we're saying, how do you cut tags? We're above our 35 bucks per 100 doe. And so this was a way to really shift permits and hunting pressure to the south and lighten it up on the north. So
what you're trying to accomplish is just to get the hunting pressure evened out on the unit?
Yeah, that's right.
I spent 6 days up there with my boy this year, and they seriously need to consider a management buck cut up there, seriously.
Yeah.
There were so many three buys and threes of mature-sized bucks, and, most of the guys won't shoot them. They'll wait till they get a 4-point, 24 inches. So... anyway, I know they've talked about that before, but that's something you ought to really consider, I think.
Well, management buck hunts, not just on the Brook Cliffs, but in a lot of our limited entry units. We hear it on Elk Ridge. We hear it, you guys hear it on the Vernon, Tom. I don't know if you do or don't, but it seems like in lots of areas around the state. So it'll certainly be something that has to be addressed in the statewide plan. The one thing I will say is if you are going to manage for 35 bucks per 100 does, you better expect to see some management bucks out there, because in order to have that many, they're not all going to be top echelon quality. You're going to have some junk in there, and that's to be expected with a high buck to doe ratio.
Yeah, but I think if you took it out of the regular limited entry permits and not increased permits just for management buck, but took it out of the overall permit numbers, it might be just fine anyway.
Yeah, and those are things that we'll certainly explore, because it's come up many times. So, yeah.
Go ahead.
Can you provide us a little more specific information on grouping those three goat units into one?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot, and Kobe, if I don't do a good enough job,
sure.
Come holler. Essentially, on Lone Peak and Box Elder Peak, over the years, the survey data has come back more depleted each year. We just seem to see fewer and fewer goats there. And then on other parts of the unit, like Temp, they're doing fine. And so there's, what we want to do is not carve out areas like send hunters to Lone Peak and all the goats have migrated one way or the other. And so we just thought this is a way to ensure that we're not selling guys camping trips, especially for a once-in-a-lifetime species. And so that way if the goats are on Lone Peak or Box Elder Peak, hunters could still access them. And if they're not seeing what they want, they can go over to Temp because Temp is doing really well. So
are you going to combine all the permit numbers for those three to keep that equal, or are you going to drop it down, or what's your thoughts?
Now I'll let Covey address that.
I guess what I would say is that we'll address that during recommendations, and that we haven't decided that yet.
I will say this though: we want our hunters to have good experiences, and so especially for mountain goats and other once in a lifetime. So, yeah.
Okay. On the, I noticed that you're gonna put the navel for Rocky Mountain Big Horn sheep in with the Wasatch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think we talked about this one time about whether or not we should kill those bighorn on Nebo. Is that kind of the reason you're doing that is because simply you don't know how long they're going to last, do you? Probably.
When you say kill, what do you mean? The population or individual
rams?
Well,
you have to kill some of those rams that are going to die of old age if you don't shoot them anyway.
I guess the best way to answer that is if we have hunting opportunity on the landscape, especially for an animal like bighorn sheep, we just want to take advantage of it.
Because there's certainly not that many there that would justify hunting them or culling them down. So
as its own unit?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But I would say, you know, if you had a 8.5 or 9-year-old ram out there, why wouldn't we include it? I mean, I don't think it's a standalone unit, but we'd only be harvesting males, which wouldn't impact the population anyway. So it's a way to provide opportunity without any population impact.
Yeah, and there's a few of those there.
Yeah, and we, you know, that's, we hear that on Temp, we hear that on Nebo, that guys are up there, they're seeing these things, and so we just wanted to open it up a little bit. So,
any other questions from the rep, Sarah?
We received a letter from Orion Cowley, if I've got that right, asking us to consider not removing the bull elk from the Sampete extended hunt. Did I get
extended
that right
hunt,
without looking at my note? Can you just explain that to me so we can better address his concerns or why you're taking the bull elk out of that hunt?
Sure.
I talked with Ryan.
Okay, go ahead, Kobe.
So, I guess...
Kobe, make sure you answer the question, too, for the...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I guess to understand this, a little bit of the history is important. And just that bull elk hunt was initiated because there was an issue with bull elk on 89. We no longer have that issue. We didn't want to take away opportunity. So we continue to have the hunt. You just can't harvest a bull. You can still harvest a cow. So I spoke with Ryan, and he shared his concerns with me, and I explained to him what I just explained to you. And I encouraged him to show up at the public process and voice his concern. Did I answer the question?
Okay.
Okay.
What's that? Yeah. One of his main points in his letter was that he didn't feel like that had much of an impact on the elk population there in the Sampete Valley anymore because there just wasn't a problem, but that it was a lot of fun for a lot of people. You know, a good experience, a lot of opportunity. He didn't see that go.
It's hard to argue with that perspective. I mean, it is, it isn't having an impact. I mean, we're killing less than 10 bulls on that unit every year. I think the issue is there alignment with having a limited entry elk hunt and then turning around and providing the permits over the counter essentially for those same bulls. And so it's more of a social issue in my mind as to what we do with that. So.
All right. Yeah. Are there any other questions?
Yeah. And sorry, Kobe, I thought you were just going to tell the story about
Okay, we'll open up the question period for points of clarification to the audience. Are there any questions or points of clarification from the audience?
Dave Woodhouse. Question on the sheep hunt. Mm-hmm. Now, you're only planning on probably one, maybe two tags, right?
Yeah, we're going to survey it. Actually, tomorrow we're going to spend some time in the air and go survey it, and that'll dictate how many permits we issue. Yeah.
Okay. My concern is, and I talked to Ryan Fouts with FNAWS, Utah FNAWS, and we need to address the availability of the unit to the governor's tag and the sportsman's tag also. Because I remember in the past when we had the Rock Canyon hunt and the Timp hunt, they were kind of every other year mm-hmm. available to one of the other tags. And I'm just worried if there does turn out to be one really good ram or whatever and you end up with a draw tag.
Yeah.
And the sportsman, you know, and or the sportsman tag, the governor's tag goes up and shoots it, and they're left with nothing to hunt, the draw tag type thing. So I was wondering if you guys have thought about that and if we were going to address that.
We can, and my thoughts on that are if you don't have the resource to take two rams out of a unit, you probably shouldn't be opening it up. And so, I mean, if we go this route and we survey, and even if we had it open 2 years or something like that, and we're not seeing the sheep and guys are, they're not getting into them and the resource isn't there, there's no sense in keeping that open. But in my mind, a lot of units are like that. A lot of our bighorn sheep units that we hunt are less than 100 animals, similar to what this Wasatch Face is going to be. And I guess that those types of permit holders are going to go where they have a good chance to get a good ram. And so I think we either open it up to all of it or not at all with it. So
okay.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if I could, you know, probably ask to maybe limit it to just the draw tag, and the sportsman and governor's tag yeah. can have what they have anyways to go hunt and keep that there. But
I think if we open that up, we would get that a lot for, well, what about the permit for the bison on the book cliffs, can we do that, but carve that out? And then it just gets really complicated. And so I think if you have the resource, we'll open it up. If the resource isn't there, we'll shut it down. I think it'll be that simple. So,
okay.
Yeah. And hopefully we have a really good resource. I mean, we're going to learn a lot tomorrow.
Yeah, there's enough. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. So.
Any other questions from the audience?
Mike Christensen. Just along those same lines, when you guys do your count, if you don't find the mature ram resource there, will you not include that in the guidebook?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because sheep flights, you always miss a lot of them. And there's our agency has got a lot of reports from guys seeing mature rams both on Timp and Nebo. And a lot of times even from the helicopter, it's a needle in the haystack type thing. But it's interesting. Sometimes we survey some of these units. We don't see these rams, and guys check them in at our offices, and we say, we would have remembered that one from the survey, and he wasn't there. And so there's a couple ways to go about this. One is ground truth in it, truthing things with surveys, which I hope we get a good survey. And then others are, what are the hunters bringing in? And so I think when you're not seeing them and hunters aren't bringing them in, that's certainly the time to shut it down. So.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess to answer your question, though, we would probably leave it open anyways based on what we've got reports on this summer.
Okay.
Just to start it this first year.
Okay, that makes sense. And then on the Box Elder, Lone Peak, Timp, uh-huh. goat herds, having grown up in that area, and is there a concern if the Lone Peak and the Box Elder units are struggling, that if people from Timp, the Timp unit transfer over onto those units. I mean, there are goats there, and they will kill goats, and, you know, not everybody's the best judge of what a goat is. Is there a concern that we might draw those temp hunters onto those other units, which historically have had a pretty good, you know, people think of those as kind of more trophy units than temp. I mean, just being from the area, that's kind of the way they're perceived. Do we worry about drawing those temp hunters over into those areas?
I think if it were a permit that guys could get year after year, I'd be probably more concerned with that, but it's a once in a lifetime. So these guys that get it, they may realize there's nice goats over there, even though the densities are low, but then they can't do anything about it anyways because their chance to hunt a goat is over. And so I think that's going to be a reality, but I don't know if it would change the recommendation at all. I can certainly see it happen, though.
Okay.
Yeah. Guys appreciating that unit a little more.
Are there any other questions from the audience? Okay, we'll open it up to the comment period from the audience. I have a comment card here, Joe Adamson.
If I can stand up. What I want to comment about is the weapons we're using nowadays. When I started hunting in 1956, we had plenty of deer, and we used 30-30s with open sights, and we all got our deer. And there's plenty of deer, 90 to 100,000 deer. Nowadays, there was no cougars or coyotes either. I had never seen a cougar I liked, but anyway. And back then, I was able to buy a Henry tag, Henry Mountains tag. You could buy two deer tag down there. $2. Me and my brother went down there, over the counter. There's that many deer. Went down there 30-30s and shot two nice deer. The only trouble we had was trying to find the biggest one. I shot a 30-incher. But anyway, that's the way it was then. I have a lifetime license, but I haven't shot a deer for 5 years because I haven't found one I really like. And I think it's ridiculous that we have these rifles that they scope in with a rangefinder and shoot 800 and 1,200 yards. That's not fair to deer. We need to get rid of that crap and save some deer. And also the bows. My boy's a boy hunter. He'd get mad if he heard me say this. But he killed bows 150 feet away, 150 yards away. He practices in my field and hits 200 yards. If we get rid of the rangefinder, he can't do that. So anyway, and some of these bulls are shooting 325 feet a second. This year in Fairview, I have a farm in Fairview. I've had it since 72. It's a hay field, and it's right in the mouth of a canyon called Birch Creek. And we can kind of tell how the deer are doing and how the cougars are doing. In the last few years, we kind of put the damper on the cougars. And back in 72, there was more deer than you wanted. But we've seen twin fawns more than I ever have since 1970. Only because we hammered the cougars and coyotes. And also, I've seen so many deer slaughtered this year. We had tons of 2 points down there. And some of these people were just slaughtered up by Electric Lake and that. They were getting four deers in just short time, 2 points. We need to maybe change some of that to 3 point or better and save some of them there, because there's a lot of fawns to survive. And I would have, the night before the deer hunt, I'd have anywhere from 60 deer in my field. That's a rifle hunt. And they're all 2 points. But anyway, it's just a crime we get going on. So if we get rid of the rangefinder, my boy admits he couldn't shoot deer without a rangefinder, we'd save a lot of deer. We'd maybe have 90,000 deer again like we had when I was a kid. So, you know what I'm saying? It's just not fair for the deer to have a rangefinder and be able to kill them that far away, bow hunters included, and all of that. So anyway, you'd make it the youth need a rangefinder. But if you make it a 1-year suspension on your license, if you're caught with a rangefinder, then you'd get their attention. They're no better than we were back in 1956 when we had to learn distance. You know, we had to judge range with a 30-30. So anyway, that's all I want to say.
Thank you very much. Okay, our next comment is Ken Strong.
Ken Strong representing myself. I know Justin just got put in this position because he knows so much that there was nobody that can compete with him. Now, I think the division has done really well on these plans that they're coming up with, both in the transplants and everything else that they've come up with on this. And I just want you to know that I support the division in their proposals that they have come forth with today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Are there any other comments? I have no more cards.
I'm Kenneth Etker. I'm representing Yuba, and we'd just like to say that we also agree with the recommendations that the DWR is presenting today. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any other comments? Troy?
Troy Justinson, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. We'd just like to support the division's recommendations. We'd have one concern, you know, considering the split on the sheep out on Range Creek and Rattlesnake. I was out there opening day. There's 17 trucks in Desolation Canyon. But my fear is if you split those seasons, you're still going to have the guys that drew the late season there, the early season scouting. So it's kind of a catch-22. Do you still allow the guys to have that amount of time and just deal with it, or do you split them up? So, but appreciate the division and all the work that they've done.
Thank you. Dave?
Dave Woodhouse, and for myself, I support the division's recommendations on what they've got down, and I'd just like to bring up that fact on the bighorn sheep here along the Wasatch Front. If you guys could address that issue with the sportsman's tag holder and the governor's tag holder being able to hunt the unit, also if we open it up. I know in the past when the temp was open and Provo was open, we had those separated where one or the other could hunt them in a year, not so that there wasn't just to control, because we do have a finite number of rams and they are there. There might be enough between the three units, you know, for all, because there's a handful of rock cane still and there's some good ones on temp and a few on Nebo, but I'd just like to see you address that issue. And you know, we've been watching the transplant on the deer a lot, and you know, if we have the predators under control, that success rate is a lot higher on the survival of the deer. And I think it's a good idea where the division is picking out these units. And if you notice how they're scattered throughout the state, means if we have a problem with deer in Logan, we have somewhere close to take them. You know, if the problem is deer in Spanish Fork, in the agricultural areas around there, which we've got a lot of, and that, or, you know, Alpine in that Bountiful, we can capture those deer. We don't always have the opportunity to put them down with lethal methods, because it's just going to cause a problem with the public. So the expense at that point becomes mute. It's, you know, not viable. And so, but we have units the way they've got it drawn up. So we appreciate the division going there, that we can move those deer too quickly without having to truck them clear across the state and whatnot. But I support the other recommendations by the division, and from what you can see, you know, we're actually growing our opportunities to hunt in the state, more bison hunts, you know, and things like, and the extra sheep hunts. And so really appreciate the work that's being done. Thanks
Dave.
Mike Christensen, just representing myself. I just want to commend the division on changing the youth age to 17 and having that hopefully in the future across the board. I think that's a great change. It covers, you know, minors and makes everything kind of on level footing. And I do have a concern with the combining the three mountain goat units into one. Having grown up at the base of those mountains my whole life, I do know that there is a perception from the public that Lone Peak and Box Elder produces better goats than Temp, and that people don't have to, you know, maybe fight the crowds on Temp, the day hikers and that. I do worry that if the population on Box Elder or Lone Peak can't support a hunt, that if we have people transfer over from the Temp area to hunt those units, I mean, let's face it, most people can't judge what a true trophy goat is. They're white, fluffy animals with black horns. And so they get up into those areas and you know, they shoot a goat. And if those areas can't sustain the harvest pressure that they're receiving currently, why would we want to put more pressure on them by bringing the Temp goats, the Temp hunters over? If you wanted to combine units, Lone Peak and Box Elder seems like that would be the units to combine, because those goats do go back and forth, but they really don't go as much through the Merrick Fork Canyon back up the other side. I know they do some, but that crossover isn't as dramatic. So I'd ask that we left it at least at 3 units, or you know, worst case at 2 units. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike. Any other comments from the audience? Justin.
It's not a comment, but I'd like to clarify something. With Dave's comment on alternating the sportsman's tag and the governor's tag, is that right, Dave? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, or even this first year, just have it open only to the tag holder.
Okay. Yeah, from the agency's perspective, I mean, there's one thing to having consistency across the board, but this is purely a social issue. If the RAC wanted to go that route, we could make that happen. It's not one worth, you know, I don't feel strongly if it went that way, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And where we don't know where those ram populations are, if the RAC wanted to go that route, we'd be happy to do so.
So we wouldn't do that until the spring.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. But it's moving ahead. Once we have those data, I mean, I guess it's not a horrible thing, is what I'm trying to say. We can do that.
Do we need to have it in place then, prior to then? Or, I mean, can they see how many rams that they count and go from there?
It's something that we'll be dealing with that next week.
Yep.
Okay. All right. We'll bring it back to the RAC for your discussion and disposition. Chris.
Justin, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about combining the 3 goat units that Mike was concerned about, especially with the pressure on Timpanogos.
Sure. That's the beauty of the public process, is we get to see different angles from the public. And from the agency's perspective, what we were trying to do is just ensure that if you drew that tag, there would be a goat there to be had. And with our flight data declining the way it is, and then seeing the growth in other areas along the Wasatch Front, we think it's more of a migrational issue than anything. Mike brings up some good points that are hard to argue against, but it was, I guess, the point we were coming from is we didn't want to have a guy wait so many years for his once in a lifetime and get there, and the goats aren't there just because they're moving around on us and different things like that. So we're just trying to expand those boundaries to give a guy a chance to go get a goat. So,
is there a concern of overharvest on any portion of the unit if you combine them?
No, I don't think our permit numbers are that high to where we're really concerned about overharvest. I mean, Kobe, you can correct me on that, but we don't have nanny hunts up there. It's hunter's choice. No, not for overharvest.
Okay.
So,
okay. Thank you.
Okay, motion's been made by Chris.
Second.
Second. Seconded by Matt. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously.
Okay, our next item is an action item. It's CWMU management plans and permit numbers for 2014. And we'll have Scott McFarland, Wildlife Program Coordinator, make that presentation.
Mr. Chairman, Regional Council, Advisory Council members. I'm Scott McFarland. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator, and I will be presenting the 2014 Buck and Bull and CWMU Landowner Association recommendations for tonight. To begin with, I better explain about what we do with the CWMUs. We receive three types of applications during the year. A new application is just that, if it's brand new, they've never been a CWMU before, or it could be an application that has where land ownership has changed more than 34% within the CWMU, or the acreage or the boundaries have changed more than 34%. We also have renewal applications. CWMUs are on a three-year application basis, and every 3 years they need to renew them if they wish to stay in the CWMU program. And change applications, the CWMUs do have the ability to change certain things on their applications and their management plans. The things that require rack and board action are the change in permit numbers, or the change in the permit allocation, or the ratio of public to private permits, or any changes in season dates. That's something that needs to be approved by the board. So for 2014, we've had four new applications. Two are due to land ownership changes that were greater than 34%, and two brand new applications. 13 CWMUs this year required renewal for 2014 to 2016 period, and 8 CWMUs submitted change applications requiring the rack and board approval. If all were approved, it would make the total to go to 119 CWMUs for the 2014 hunting season. As an overview, like I said, there's 119 proposed CWMUs. The northern region has 72 of those. They take the lion's share of them in the state, and it's mainly due to the amount of private property in the northern part of the state. Northeastern has 5, central region has 12 CWMUs, southeastern is 17, and southern region has 13 CWMUs. In the program, there's over 2.16 million acres enrolled. 96% of that property is private land, and there's about 446 private landowners that participate in the CWMU program. So for 2014, the proposed number of permits, I've got this broke down into public and private, and the various species there, but as a total, there would be 2,938 private permits and 469 public permits, which represent about 14% of the total permits. That's for bucks and bulls only. Okay, I'll go over the recommendations by region. Northern region had 3 new applications. The Grouse Creek is a previous one. It changed ownership. There was very little changes to the application from the previous one, and the division recommends approval of that. Hartscrabble is the same thing. It changed ownership, and the division, it's a deer, elk, and moose CWMU. The division recommends approval of that. And the TL Bar Ranch is a new pronghorn CWMU that it was applied for, and the division also recommends approval of that application. They had, I won't count them there. These are the ones that came up for renewal this year. They're at the end of their three-year application period. There's Blue Creek, Grass Valley, Clark Canyon, Jacobs Creek, Lazy H Ranch, Mountaintop, Neal Creek, Stillman Creek Ranch, TJ Cattle Company, and the Woodruff Creek South. These are all renewal applications. Some of them have minor changes to their previous applications, but most of them are pretty much the same. They may have adjusted permit numbers up or down, and the division recommends approval of all of those. Change applications, these are the ones that applied for changes to their current management plans and applications. Whites Valley requested that they decrease their buck deer permits, and most of these are due to population fluctuations. So if they're decreasing, it's because they're probably seeing a decrease in the number of animals on these CWMUs. They were 20. They're requesting it to go to 13 with a corresponding split, and the division recommends approval of that. The Deseret Land Livestock, the Deseret CWMU is a deer, elk, moose, and pronghorn CWMU. They added 4,489 private acres. Most of this was winter range that they added to give incentive for those landowners to manage their properties for winter range, and they added a few permits to compensate for that. They also requesting to change the elk public-private ratio from 85-15 to 90-10. And what that does for them is if with a 90-10 ratio, the public gets 100% of the a 90-ton buck bull ratio, and the public gets 100% of the antlerless permits that are offered on that, which is usually, the last few years, it's been in the around 250 to 260 antlerless elk permits. Washakie added 10 buck deer permits. They were 10, and they requested a total of 20 with a corresponding split, and the division recommends approval of that. Nucor West, they're requesting a decrease in the number of buck deer permits from 20 to 10 with a corresponding split, and we recommend approval of that. Ingham Peak, it was currently just a deer CWMU. They wanted to add elk to the application. They're requesting 6 total elk permits with a split of 4 and 2 because of the public lands that are included in that CWMU. We recommend approval of that also. In the southeastern region, we had this is the first page of it. The Spring Canyon is a new application for a deer CWMU. Our division is recommending denial of that application, and I do have a map of that because there will be some discussion on that, and it's because of insufficient contiguous acreage to make the CWMU fit our rule. The Red Ranches is a renewal. There's no changes from the previous application. We recommend approval of that. Minimod Ridge, this is something that will require action. Is the division recommends approval of the CWMU, but they want to include a state section that was previously taken out at the request of the board, the Wildlife Board. They want to include that back in. What this would do is it wouldn't increase their private permits, but it would increase the public permits if that was included in that. The southeastern regions continued. Emma Park is a renewal. It was basically the same except for they decreased acreage by 637 acres. We recommend approval of that. Schofield Canyons is a change application. They request to decrease their buck deer permits from 20 to 10 with a corresponding split, and we recommend approval of that also. Southern region applications, we have Black Point. That was under renewal. It's a pronghorn CWMU. They recommend approval of that. There's no changes from the previous application. In Oak Ranch, it's a change application, and we recommend approval. They want to decrease their deer permits from 19 to 14 with a corresponding split. The central region applications, we had one, it's Coyote Little Pole. qualified for one more private bull elk permit. It was at 6 at a 5-1 split, and they request to go add additional one as a 6-1 split, 7 total, and we recommend approval of that. Okay, that's it for the CWMU recommendations.
Thank you, Scott. Are there any questions from the RAC? Larry.
Spring Canyon, you recommend denial of it?
Yes.
You said insufficient contiguous lands. They have just under 5,000 acres. That's 8 acres they were short.
The numbers have changed through this process in the last couple months. At the time when I put the recommendations in there, if we include, probably the best thing to do is let me bring up a map on this, and it'll be better to explain it. And I do have a map of it. Okay, this is a map of the proposed Spring Canyon CWMU. By rule, in order to make the minimum acreage, the properties can't be touching corner to corner. They have to be contiguous. And if you look at the two blue pieces that say gather them there, they are touching corner to corner. What the CWMU has requested that we allow the SITLA 600 acres right in the middle to be included in the CWMU, to join that up to make the minimum acreage. If the SITLA section was included with all the other acreage, there's also 160 acres of BLM property in the yellow there that would be included. This number would come up to 5,017 acres if the SITLA property was included. Without it, it comes up, you know, substantially short of the 5,000 acre minimum. The only way that the public property can be included into the CWMU, there's three criteria that takes. One is to be completely surrounded by private property or otherwise inaccessible to the public. That's the first criteria. This other one is it's needed to make a definable boundary, or the third one is it's needed to reach the management objectives for the unit, for that wildlife species. The first one it doesn't qualify for, because that does have public access according to the region. So
why can BLM property just be taken out of the?
Pardon me?
Why couldn't the private property or the BLM property just be taken out of the CWMU and leave it as public property? Maybe I misunderstood.
What I'm saying is that the BLM, the yellow pieces there,
yeah,
they do qualify because they are completely surrounded by private property, and basically there's no public access to them. So those can be included in it. It's the SITLA section in the middle, the orange section.
That's private.
That's SITLA. That's state lands.
State
trust. Yeah, school trust lands, and that one, it does. It's bordered by all of BLM land to the south there, and it does have public access. And so it, you know, as much as we'd like to put this into a CWMU, it does not fit the rule. That's why we're recommending denial of it.
Well, I think it's kind of a shame because it's so close to meeting the criteria.
It is.
I've been through the same thing personally. You are connecting border to border. But,
well, and we've visited with the people that are trying to get this to put together, and probably the best solution is to approach SITLA to purchase some property for them that will make that so that it's not touching corner to corner, to make it compliant. You know, it'd have to be done in the future. It couldn't be done this year, obviously. But
thanks.
Okay. Yes.
Just a curiosity question. We have 119 CWMUs, and we only had 13 renewal applications. And I think you said it was like a 3-year cycle. Does that mean we're going to have 100 next year?
Next year, I think we're going to have close to 80. That will be. Yeah, it's going to be grueling. there will be.
I'm planning my vacation now.
Yeah, not all of the CWMUs are on the same cycle. They started out that way several years ago when we went to a three-year application, but some of them have changed, you know, ownership, and so they started new, and then new ones have come in, and I think it's somewhere around 80 that will be coming up for next year. So,
any other questions from the RAC? Okay, we'll turn the time to the audience for questions or points of clarification.
I can come up with the comments if you'd like. I'm Floyd Hatch, and I'm representing the applicant on this issue.
Okay.
Would you like me to come up for comments, or can I?
If you have questions, now would be the time. Comments.
I have a clarification, so should I wait?
If you're asking for a clarification, ask now.
The only, and again, I can come up. The only point I want to make is that nobody tried to pull anything here. I'm a real estate broker, and I represent Mr. Gatherum. I also have my own CWMU, and Scott has just been a wonderful help and friend on ours up in Morgan County. So we're in this together. We're a team. Our contention was that the public access isn't what it appears to be. The only access to that Sitla section is coming right up through the middle, through the bottom of that canyon. To get to that Sitla acreage, one would have to hike, pack, do whatever they're going to do through well over a mile of ground. And that's fine for a pack trip, but it'd be a lot more difficult to pack the buck out. And so nobody's trying to pull anything. We understand what needs to be done. We'll be back. We're talking with Sitla. There's one more piece that sits between the yellow that we're working on a lease right now, so there'll be 40 more acres that come in. There's never going to be an issue as to whether we've got enough acres with the 5,000. We will have that. And it's just a matter of how we're going to get there, and I just want to make sure that we made it clear that we weren't trying to pull something. We're working on that, and we still believe that the public access to that Sitla piece is pretty difficult to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions or points of clarification from the audience? Okay, are there any other comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the RAC for their disposition and motion. Richard.
Yes, it is. One of the things that I'm concerned with, and some of the comments that I've received from different people, and especially at this issue now, is that you want to take public ground and take it away from the public. I know there's a way to do it, and it's all legal and everything, but that doesn't sit well. And that's a lot of acreage to take away from the public. I don't care if they're backpacking or walking their dog. You know, I think there's an issue there. Now, if you buy it, that's a different issue. But I think that we really need to be kind of careful about taking it away from public people. You know, the public pays the lion's share of the permits, for the opportunity, and if we're going to take public grounds and do that kind of thing with them, there's going to become a big pushback about that, and I think we need to be aware of that. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Any other discussion? Okay, a motion is made by Chris to approve as presented. Is there a second? Timothy? It's been motioned and seconded. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Our next item is also an action item. It's the landowner permit numbers for 2014, and Scott McFarland will be presenting that to us as well.
Okay, thank you. I will be presenting the Landowner Association voucher recommendations. Permits come to the Landowner Association not as permits, but they come as vouchers that they redeem for permits. And just for a little overview of the Landowner Association, the Landowner Association can be formed in their landowner permit rule if landowners within a limited entry unit for deer, elk, or pronghorn can enroll at least 51% of the private properties that are located in that unit. And what they do is they qualify for a corresponding percentage of the acreage as how much acreage that they are rolling in it. For example, if there were 100 acres in the unit and they had 10%, they would be 10% of the properties in there, they would qualify for 10% of the permits, to make it simple. So these are the Landowner Association recommendations. We received 15 applications this year, and the division recommends approval of 12 of those applications as received, and we had three split recommendations on there where there was a disagreement between what should be, what they qualified for and what they wanted. So how this breaks down too is there'd be, out of the 15 landowner associations, there would be 115 deer vouchers, buck deer vouchers, of which one of those would be a management buck voucher. It's on the Ponsagant. 76 elk vouchers and 8 pronghorn vouchers is what it comes out to be. Okay, and the split recommendations on these are, the Vernon Landowner Association requested 35 vouchers on this, and they qualify for 28, and the division recommends 28 on this. And the reduction is due to the decrease in the overall permit numbers that are offered for the limited entry unit for deer. Ponsagant Landowner Association, the number of management deer, buck deer permits, it was drastically reduced, and they're requesting 4. That's what they've had in the past, but they qualify for because of the reduction in permits for 1 permit, and the division is recommending 1 permit on that. Panguitch Lake Landowner Association, that has been resolved. They agree with the 7 permits that the division recommended or what they qualify for. Indian Peaks Landowner Association, this is something they request every year. They request, it's not, the disagreement isn't over the number, but they request that they make them 3 premium permits instead of the regular permits. The rule does not allow for that. That's a request on that. So what the premium permits would allow them to hunt all of the seasons, basically. So. And there was another, under the same action item, all the information has been sent to the RAC and on the proposed rule change, but because of it not being clear in the agenda, what we've decided to do is take this through the next the December RAC and board meetings to make sure that it gets made clear on the agenda, so that we'll be taken through that. We won't address that on this at this time. Okay.
Thank you, Scott. Are there any questions from the RAC? Yes, Chris.
I don't know if somebody from the Landowners Association is here and can answer the question better, but on some of those split recommendations, could you give a little more detail on what the disagreement is there?
What the landowners would like to have a certain number of permits. What happens is, the way this works with the Landowner Association is that there's a total number of permits that are recommended for the limited entry unit. For example, if it was an elk unit and they had 50 permits, and the landowner had the Landowner Association had 10% of the properties in there, they would qualify for 5 permits. But if that number goes down, they have to take we recommend a corresponding decrease in the number of permits. They still will only qualify for 10% of those permits, and as the permits lower, it's lowered for the public and for the private property for their split on that. So
if you don't lower it for the Landowner Association, then either A, you got to take more permits from the public.
That's correct.
Or B, harvest more elk than you want to harvest.
That's correct. Yeah, it has to come from somewhere. There's only in that pool. There's only so many permits. So it's either you raise the objective or the number of permits in the unit, or you take them from the public part of the. Part of that permit pool.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the RAC? Larry?
Say in the Vernon unit, why are you lowering the permits?
I couldn't speak that. I'd have to have the region address that. So
it's basically just like anything else. When we make recommendations, sometimes we have more permits some years, some we have less. Just that turned out this year. We're on a one-year lag with the Landowners Association, so everything's built off of what happened last year. And last year, the recommendation was to go down based on buck-to-doe ratios, fawn-to-doe ratios, all the things that we make recommendations on. So we went from 200 to like 187 or something like that. So it was a slight lowering of the permit. So it corresponds with the 14% that the Landowners Association actually qualifies for. The chairman asks for 35 every year, regardless of what it is, and you know that as well as I do. So,
but, you know, this is one of those units that there's probably should be a maximum. You know, you have a little humongous 2x3s out there, 28 inches long, and nobody wants to shoot because it's not a great year.
Some of those were left over from the 3 years we were closed. And we've kind of continued. That's just what's out there. We do have a lot of big 2 points and a lot of big 3 points. It's a desert unit. It's a summer range limited. I think that's one of those units that you got to be real careful about talking to the management about permits, because that's just what's out there. And if you started probably pushing. There's some nice ones, but it's not. When you look at antler configurations, there are some goofy ones, and they're just that's the way they are. I don't know that you'll ever see very many like the Ponsagant or maybe the Henrys out there, but it's a desert unit that's summer range limited. And
but on your counts, we seem to have.
So far, so good. It's looking pretty good on the Verdon. We've got the fawn to doe ratio up really good now, and I think this year we'll see a little bit better buck to doe ratio. So it's all going to come back probably next year, and the Landowners Association, they could maybe qualify for more than 35. I mean, the year before last, they were 37, I believe. And so it's one of those things that fluctuates, you know. But he asked for 35 to as kind of a basis for the way he's got the bylaws set up, and sometimes it works for him and sometimes it doesn't. He might have to have a drawing on some of those, the way he's got the bylaws set up in the landowners. So.
Thank you, Larry. Any other questions? Comments?
I maybe can clarify that a little bit also. What Tom said, that there's a one-year lag on this. The bucks and bull recommendations aren't made until winter's over. They're done in the spring. These recommendations for the landowner associations are done in the fall, so we have to go on the previous year's numbers. And it can work for or against a landowner association. They might qualify for, may get more than the public will one year, and they might get less. It's just because it's on a one-year lag like that. So it's just the way that our recommendation process is set up. So.
Are there any other questions from the REC? Do we have any questions or points of clarification from the audience? Comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the REC for a disposition and vote. Okay.
Make motion to accept as presented.
Okay. Motion is made by Chris to accept the motion or accept the proposal as the division's presented. Is there a second? Timothy? Motion's been moved and seconded. All in favor? All opposed? Okay. Did you vote?
I did.
Okay. Nine in favor and one abstain. Voting's unanimous. Okay, our next item is another action item. It's the Utah Hunter Mentoring Program. It's a new rule. And we have Greg Hansen here to talk to us about that. He's the Assistant Attorney General.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the RAC. My name is Greg Hansen. I'm here to present a new administrative rule and permit program proposed by the Division of the Utah Hunter Mentoring Program. Last year, the Utah Legislature passed amendments to the Wildlife Code in 2319 and 1 that allowed limited sharing of a hunting permit by certain classifications of children in an effort to recruit youth into the sport, provide a mechanism where mentoring could occur with these children to teach them proper hunting ethics and safety, and to encourage hunting in Utah as a family experience. The division took those code changes and drafted a new administrative rule that would govern how that program's operated. There are certain limitations. Both the minor children and the mentoring adults have to meet qualifications that are set up in code and clarified in rule. We created an administrative process to ensure that everybody that participates qualifies for the program, and to track how these permits are used, hopefully show that this program is recruiting youth into the sport, and show where these youth are hunting. And then ensure that when these permits are shared, the mentoring process is actually happening out in the field. So there are descriptions of what has to happen when the mentor and the child are out in the field to ensure that they're learning the ethics and safety that we're after. So can my child participate in this program? The program is limited to Utah residents. The children must be between the ages of 12 and 17 when they're hunting, and they must possess a Utah Hunter's education number. There are two different classifications of children that qualify for this program. The first is a child that is the child, stepchild, grandchild, or legal ward of the mentor, or the other type of child that qualifies as one that's suffering from a life-threatening medical condition. So those children don't have to be directly related to the mentor, but we want to offer them the opportunity to get out in the field as well. Hunting mentors can be either residents or non-residents. They must possess a valid big game permit. They must be 21 years or older when out in the field with the child that they're mentoring. And the mentor and the child must comply with all elements of the Wildlife Code, the administrative rules, and the limitations given in the hunting big game proclamation. One element that's really important to this program is that no compensation to the hunting mentor is allowed. So we want this to be a family experience, not a money-making endeavor for mentors to take children out into the field. If you believe that your child qualifies for this hunt, we've set up a process to ensure that the proper documentation is in order. At least 10 days before the requested date of permit sharing, we ask that you submit an application. There'll be a $10 handling fee associated with that, the documentation that the division puts together. And we request the hunting mentor provide all elements of proving that both the mentor and the child qualify to participate in the program. So they'll have to provide the permit number, which we've initially opened the program up to all big game hunting permits, a description of the minor's hunter education number, and a certification from the minor and the mentor that they qualify for the program, so that they are the child, stepchild, grandchild, or legal ward of the mentor, or that they have a life-threatening medical condition. If the child that will be participating in the program is not the if the mentor is not the legal guardian of the child that's participating in the program, we'll also require a written authorization from the minor's parents to ensure that the child that's out in the parent of the child that's out in the field is okay with that individual supervising their child for this activity. We've also limited the permit sharing to one minor mentor pair per permit. This is to ensure that proper mentoring is actually occurring, so that there's not three or four children all out on the hunt. Also for safety reasons, we felt that it was probably prudent, at least in the initial stages of this program, to limit it to one minor mentor, to ensure that full focus is on the mentee that's out in the field. But we have provided a system that if you want to share your permit with, say, another child in your family, you can surrender the one certification for the first child, submit a new application, and have that permit shared with the second child. It's just a duplication of the administrative process. If you do qualify and you're approved by the division, there are limitations out in the field. The mentor must be close enough to the minor to communicate with voice or hand signals. That parrots the language that's found in the Wildlife Code for youth under the age of 16 when they're out in the field. It's the same standard for this program. We ask that the mentor provide advice and assistance with techniques, safety, and ethics. That's kind of the theme of the program. We want to ensure that that's actually happening. And we also ask that the mentor possess all of the elements that they submitted to the division that prove they qualify for the program. So the permit, their hunting license, all of the certifications that were required to show that they qualify for the program, and the division approval that they've gone through the process and we verified that they qualify. You'll notice the license word up there is starred. We've waived the hunting license requirement for the child to participate in the program as an incentive to get them out there. So that's a little carrot to encourage people to participate in this program. Both the minor and the mentor may carry a firearm, but only one animal is allowed to be taken and tagged. So even though there are two individuals out in the field, it's still one permit, one animal. The effects of sharing a permit, all the rules, variances, surrenders, refunds, disability, and disability accommodations are based on the type of permit and the individual using the permit. And second, bonus points, preference points, and waiting periods are assessed to the mentor, the individual that originally drew the permit, not the child. And with that, I thank you for your time.
So is this just deer and elk, or is it all big game?
All big game.
So theoretically, a little kid could shoot a mountain goat on his dad's tag and then get another mountain goat tag on a once-in-a-lifetime?
Sure could.
Okay.
The way that we've set the program up is it's not actually a transfer of the permit. It's a sharing. And so the permit name is still with the original permit holder, not the child. But if that child was to draw another once-in-a-lifetime species later, they would still qualify to take a second animal.
So once you get to the very end of the line and the tables are switched, can you have a young guy mentoring an old guy?
No, the way the code provision is written, it has to be a minor under the age of 18 while they're hunting.
Okay. Questions from the rack? Matt?
I don't have a question. I just... Hats off to the legislature and the division for promoting this kind of activity. I think this is a wonderful program, and I'm hopefully encouraging the RAC members to approve this as well. So thank you.
The division's pretty excited about it as well.
Yeah. Go ahead. Does the mentor or the child have to be a resident of the state?
Yes, he does. Okay. She too.
So the mentor can be non-resident.
Yes.
Right, and that's like a grandchild or something over here. Okay.
And that's actually provided for in the code section. So we were limited to those classifications based on what the legislature passed.
Go ahead, Carl.
I too really like this program. The only concern I have with it is you've got one permit and one animal and two guns. And so that's... I'd love to see this move forward, but... Mm-hmm. That's my concern, and as long as that's in the motion, I'll have to vote against it. But one, two.
Yeah, we have those same concerns as well, and we really put the onus on the mentor to make sure that they're in control of the hunting situation.
Danny.
So this is pretty easy. So dad swaps the permit to the other kid. I assume that the money-making opportunity is an additional $10 for the other kid. Each time he reapplies, another $10. Is that correct?
We would charge a $10 processing fee for each sharing process.
So if the hunt was, 2 weeks long, then... And you had enough kids, you could just keep swapping it.
and right now we do have a 10-day application period in there, so you are going to be limited by the amount of time it takes to process. Okay.
Yeah.
But
so that is a problem. So probably realistically, it'd probably be like 2 kids.
At most, yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions from the RAC? Larry?
No, I have comments.
Okay. Sarah?
The division is a champion at getting special needs kids out for fishing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our sportsmen groups in conjunction with the division also champions getting these disabled kids out. Mm-hmm. Is there a possibility to maybe roll some of those kids into the piece where... this child can be taken out, say they're in a wheelchair or bound by some other disability. Can they be taken out by someone other than the legal guardian? I mean, have we talked about that, or is there a possibility to roll that in as well?
I believe that there could be the possibility in the future. Right now, the way the code section is written, it's either those familial relations that we talked about or a life-threatening medical condition. And so disability accommodations that don't fit that second category probably wouldn't qualify under the code section. We'd have to go back to the legislature and request further amendments to code in order to do that. But I can imagine there'd be some support for that. We just have to see how the legislative winds are.
Any other questions from the RAC? Okay, we'll open up the question time for the audience.
So if a disabled mentor qualifies for the extended hunting portion of the tag, an able-bodied mentee can hunt during that portion?
That's a curveball. The way we've written the rule is that disability accommodations are based on the type of permit and the individual using the permit. And so, because the permit would still be in the disabled mentor's name, my interpretation would be that the mentee would be able to go out in the field with them. That's something that we'd have to look at and analyze when that certain situation came in. But if they're sharing the permit and there's an allowance for the mentor to be out in the field, the mentee should be able to go with them. That would be my gut feeling, but that's definitely something we're going to have to look at.
That's the way I interpreted it also. And is it a 40% disabled? Is anybody from the division?
Yeah.
Is it 40%? If you're disabled 40% in your mobility, then you can qualify for the disabled.
Yeah. There's a section in our administrative rule that governs specific to disabled accommodations. And we also have ADA accommodations that are outside of administrative rule too. So it comes down to a case-by-case basis in a lot of situations.
Okay. Okay. All right. I guess I'd have a comment.
Thank you, Mike Christensen. Any other questions from the audience? Okay, any comments from the audience? Dave Woodhouse?
Dave Woodhouse, and first off, representing SFW, and we spent a lot of time getting this passed through the legislature, so the group really supports this, and you know we put a lot of time and effort in getting the legislature to support it and push it, and so we're really excited to see this happen. And you know, I haven't heard anything bad. On a personal note, I agree with Carl. The two guns, one license. I don't like that. You know, I just hunted in Wyoming. I had a tag. My daughter had a tag. We just carried one gun. We only killed one deer. But that's, you know, she did it. And that's fine. That's great. I didn't need to. But I would ask this rec to maybe address that and put it out there that, you know, that it'd be one gun carried by the mentee. And with the mentor there helping them, maybe even carrying the gun. It doesn't matter, you know, but one gun between the two. Then we don't have a confusion of possibility of, you know, walk around the corner and boom, boom, two dead deer, and we have a bad situation. That's, you know, we could avoid that with, if you know, and I'd like to see this rec maybe just address that and put that in, and then it can go before the board and they can, you know, maybe do something there. But I would ask that. And to Mike's point too, the disabled hunter, if he's the mentor or she's the mentor with the child, they're still going to be limited to where the disabled and how the disabled person can hunt, basically. Because if the mobility is limited, they can't take him out in the field in the same way that someone that's fully healthy can do. So I don't see that being, there is an issue there. I don't see it as a make or break issue at this point. So like I say, I'm really excited to see this program go forward, and thanks for your time.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yeah, of course.
Not to make it messy,
mm-hmm.
But so if a guy's restricted to his vehicle, he hunts from his vehicle because he's disabled, he's mentoring a kid, the kid hunts from the vehicle, or he can, like, send him around the... I mean...
And
I know you're going to have to look at that.
Yeah. Yeah. The type of accommodation would be specific to the individual, but if the mentor-mentee pair is hunting together, we'd have to make sure that if the child was the one taking the animal, they were within, you know, close proximity to the mentor still. And so hunting from a vehicle might be an accommodation allowed for the mentor, but how you allow that for the mentee at the same time when they don't have that same disability is going to be something we have to look closely at and sort out. Some good points, definitely.
Can you share the logic behind the bringing two guns?
Yes. One point of clarification was if we're offering once-in-a-lifetime species opportunities, take a child out for the first time, they freeze up, a parent has then potentially lost their once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for that animal. That was one thing that came up. You know, the there are a lot of situations like that, and we're very cognizant of the possible law enforcement issues that could come up, and we don't want that child's first hunting experience to be a traumatic one. So that's something we'll have to work out with law enforcement, definitely.
Well, Greg, there's another, you know, reason I would think is that the child may require a gun that's going to be a different size,
yes.
And perhaps a different caliber.
Yeah.
And so that requiring, you have to decide, okay, is the mentor going to shoot with a 243 that has a 12-inch, you know, stock, or, you know, I think
definitely.
That's problematic.
Yep.
But you can't decide that. You have to decide that 10 days before anyway, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's got to be decided 10 days before. The permit's got to be in either the mentor or the youth's name.
No,
it's shared.
Shared.
Yeah. Yes.
So
either the
comes up and the father could shoot it.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Tim.
Hopefully.
Legislation, law that was passed, does it specify bull carrying?
No.
Okay, that's a PWR.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Danny.
Yeah, I agree that two guns are the way to go. You know, I was mentoring a kid, and he put the deer down, but it was wounded, and then he froze up, or he couldn't see it, or whatever, mm-hmm. you know. And so I had to take the animal, and that worked out. Had I not been able to take that animal, it would have got away, and it would have died later somewhere else, I'm sure, from what we saw later on. So I think you guys have done a great job, and I think that'll really work. It all boils down to the mentor anyway. So
yeah. Any other questions? Go ahead, Carl.
I guess I see the two weapons different. If I'm going to share a tag, I want to share the tag. I want to share the hunt. I want to make that decision before mm-hmm. on that. There may be some what-ifs, mm-hmm. but I think there's what-ifs both ways. If you're going to authorize them to share a tag, let's share the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And at least in my opinion, one gun's the way to share the hunt.
Yep.
So.
Any other questions from the rack? Questions or points of clarification from the audience? Are there any comments from the audience?
Kenneth Edgar, representing myself. I just want to say I agree. I don't mind seeing the two weapons out there. Just like it says in there, this is teaching ethics. We've all been on the mountain plenty of times. I was out hunting elk for over 20 days this year, and I'm sure I could have packed off more than one or two animals off the hill that nobody knew about. So that's what we're all here about. We're trying to teach the ethics. Like I said, we've all been by somebody that's been flustered or something. I still get flustered shooting something. I mean, if I had an animal that was getting away and I still had the tag legally, I could fill it, I would want to be able to do that for my kid or mentor to hopefully preserve that experience. Otherwise, it may ruin it for them. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other comments from the audience? Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the rack for your...
I'll make a motion that we accept the mentoring program as presented by the division.
Motion is made.
Are you the division?
I'm with the Attorney General's office, but I represent Wildlife
He's
Resources.
Not dressed like those guys.
So.
He's a spy.
They haven't given me a brown uniform yet.
Okay, motion made by Matt. Seconded by Chris Marble. All in favor? Oh, wait a second. Question on the motion? Go ahead. I'm sorry. I apologize, guys. Comment, Larry.
I'm sorry to screw this all up. Give us a mistake, one second.
Not at all.
I agree with what they're doing, man. But this is something that's common sense. This should be. Every new hunter, every young kid should have a mentor with him. I think it should be mandatory. There shouldn't be a 12-year-old kid out on a mountain by himself.
It is, isn't it?
Anyway. Yeah. So, yeah, I agree with what you're doing, but it should go further than just saying, one tag or two tags. You got a young kid. Kids mature differently. I know some kids that are able to hunt at a younger age, but I know a lot of kids that shouldn't have guns. I know some older people.
Most definitely.
So, you can pick it up from there, Gary. That was my comment.
Okay, thank you. I think there is a law in place. You can't. 12-year-olds have to be with their dad or an older person.
Yeah.
Until you're older.
16 and under.
Right.
Or under 16.
Under 16.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Motion's been made by Matt, seconded by Chris. To accept the division's proposal as presented. All in favor? Nine to one. Okay, motion passes with a vote of nine. Those against? Okay, one. Okay, the motion passes.
Thank you.
Next item is an action item, and it's with regards to the Oak Creek Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep Management Plan, and it's Dustin Scheibel. Oh, no, sorry.
We skipped him. Do we want to go in that order, or do we want to go on?
We need to go in the order that's on the agenda.
Okay.
Okay, our next item is an action item. It's the dedicated hunter rule and amendment. Brian Christensen, the dedicated hunter program coordinator, will be presenting this.
Okay, thank you. Again, I'm Brian Christensen, dedicated hunter coordinator, work in the Salt Lake office. And the dedicated hunter rule was last revised when we went from the unit by the regional hunting into unit hunting. Since then, we've identified a few things that we needed clarified, as we've learned along the way with unit-based hunting. And we've also found several things within the rule as we combed it out that either just didn't need to be in there or were located in other places, other rules. So essentially what this is a revision to reorganize it, make the rule easier to read, simplify it, cut it down, clarify some of the things, as I mentioned, and then it also gave us an opportunity to address a Wildlife Board action item that they'd asked us to look at. As far as simplification goes, what we've done is we've taken out all of the wording that was unique to 2012. There were some sections that were to address transitioning the existing dedicated hunters from 2011 into the 2012 unit structure, and that all could just be taken out. We've removed dates on when the division is required to print, or rather not print, dedicated hunter permits. We've just left that more open. Next one there is that dedicated hunters currently, if they finish their program 3 years and still have hours, and what that would mean is that they didn't redeem all the permits they had. They still owed hours to the division, service hours. They're required now to pay off those hours, and we feel it's justifiable to allow them to do that or jump on a project and work off those hours instead. I think we'd rather see them out in the field. if they're outstanding on hours after that third year. The last one there is to broaden the time frame in which the permits can be returned. Each dedicated hunter has to turn their permits back in order to show they did not harvest a deer, because that's one of the requirements in the program is a 2-deer and 3-year agreement. And in the years past, it's been a January or a March time frame. The way that the program runs and quotas are organized, we don't need that hard date anymore. We can actually be more open with when the permits are returned. So for clarifications and then basic updates, the COR currently expires the last day of the year. There is a remote possibility that general season hunts could go beyond December. You know, technically they could go into January. We haven't run into that, but we just wanted to make this rule fit just in case they ever did. The definition of youth, as Justin presented earlier tonight, we would also incorporate that same definition into the dedicated hunter program. The preference points, we've added a section that talks about when a surrendered certificate of registration may be eligible for point reinstatement, just like somebody that had a general season deer permit. When they surrender, sometimes they're eligible to have their points back, sometimes they're not. The poaching reported reward permit, we've added one small section there that in the case that a dedicated hunter has a dedicated hunter permit to be issued and has the opportunity to accept a poaching rewards reported rewards permit, it tells them what options they've got that just didn't exist before, and we ran into that this year. And then the last part here on this section, we've added a definition, program orientation course, and that's actually going to be inserted into Rule 657-62. It's the application procedure rule. That rule talks about this orientation and didn't have the definition in it at that point, so we've just moved it into there. As far as the action log item, we've been asked, and I'll read this word for word here, for the DWR to reconsider allowing dedicated hunter program applicants to accrue volunteer hours in the first year after they apply in the program rather than waiting until the final selections and approval. So we looked into this for quite a long time, a lot of discussion, a lot of exploration, and we did come up with a couple of ways that dedicated hunters could essentially earn hours prior to actually being in the program. And we looked at, like I say, several ways that this could happen. But basically what it came down to is each scenario we came up with had things that could occur, different situations that made it so that it either wasn't equitable to the dedicated hunter or it wasn't equitable to the division. And so what we did instead is we looked at, you know, what is the goal here? What do we really want to achieve? And there are a couple of things. One of them was to give the dedicated hunters that are entering the program more time. And you can see on this slide here, we typically find out if we're in the program around May 31st. That's normally when the results come out. It gives a first-year dedicated hunter about 10 weeks to do the first 8 hours of service before the archery hunt starts. So that's a bit of a pinch. And on the slide there, I've indicated this year we had basically about 19,000 hours we had to get done in that short time period. So one of the goals that this action log item was to address was that short time frame. How do we get a lot of people, a lot of hours real quick? And so instead of creating a structure in which dedicated hunters could basically store up hours before they were in the program, what we did is we came up with an alternative that we feel is actually beneficial to both the division and the project timeline and the dedicated hunter. So we revisited all these options and developed a system in which the dedicated hunter that joins up just has to do their conservation and ethics course that first year, can redeem the first permit, and then the next year needs to do 16 hours before they can redeem that second permit. The third year, 16 hours. So the requirement is still the same at 32 hours. The distribution between years has just changed a little. Right now it's 8 hours for the first permit, 16 for the next one, and then 8 for the last. So what we see here is that this is we feel strongly that this is an opportunity for a lot more time for dedicated hunter to get those hours done that first year, and may even really promote those spring projects that both the division and our the federal agency partners and our conservation group partners would really like to see bolstered, whereas now hunters are kind of waiting until they draw and then they start jumping on those projects. So this is the recommendation we have to just change that, those 3 years, 0 hours required for the first year, 16 the second, 16 the third. That's what I have. I'll take whatever questions you have for me.
Thank you. Is there any questions from the rec? Sarah?
Would they still be allowed to complete as many as they like, as early as they like?
Absolutely. Yeah, they're still required to have their hours done within their enrollment period. So as soon as they join up, they can do all 32 that year, or they could do 60 that year. But the hours have to be within their three-year enrollment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and many of them do. A lot of them like to get them done right off.
Any other questions? Chris?
I'm assuming the definition of general deer season means the end of the extended archery period as well.
Right, yeah, and that's... when we read through this, it didn't really say what the last day of the hunt was, and the last day of the hunt is, if the extended season ends December 1st, that's going to be the last day. If it ends December 31st, that's the last day. Yeah.
Any other questions from the rec? Questions from the audience? Okay, is there any opinions or statements want to be made by the audience? All right, we'll bring it back to the rec. Richard.
Yeah, I'd like to know which one of the division personnel have to wear ties and who don't.
I'm not sure.
Is this a pecking order or what?
As far as how many years it's been running?
Yeah.
Since 1995. So a bunch. Yeah.
Danny.
Yeah, I really like this change. One thing I've noticed over the years is that initial crunch puts a crunch not just on the dedicated hunters, but on the division. It becomes a hassle for the division to deal with that all at once. And so this, I think, will help spread it all out, and I like it.
I like that about it too. Before everybody was scrambling trying to get their stuff done so they could get their first tag, and this will make it so you can actually effectively use the hours instead of just looking for stuff for them to do right there at the last minute. I think it's a good idea. I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion. We accept the 2014 Dedicated Hunter Program recommendations as presented.
Motion made by Matt. Seconded by Carl. Any discussion on the motion? Any questions on the motion?
Okay. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Next item is an action item. It is the Oak Creek Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep Management Plan. And we have Riley Peck, who's a wildlife biologist, here to present that to us.
Yeah, thank you. It said on the schedule Dustin Shively would be presenting, but he's at home with the flu, or at least pretending to.
That's what he said.
Yeah. Something about too nauseous to drive up here or something. I don't know.
May I have your attention, please? The time is now 8:45, and the library will be closing in 15 minutes. If you have any questions, please come to the desk now or find the nearest librarian, and we are happy to help you. Thank you.
We'll be quick regardless, right? Yeah. Okay.
You got till 10. You don't need it.
No, we'll be really fast. So, so just to give us a little background and the purpose for this today, the Oak Creek Management Unit is in between Oak City and kind of Mills and Scipio. So Scipio and Delta, or Oak City and Mills, where whatever city or towns you're familiar with, runs right to the west of I-15, and it's an area that was historically occupied with bighorn sheep, and has been through the statewide sheep management plan and approved to have bighorn sheep there again. So we're here tonight to just propose the new unit management plan. On the continue with some background, in last year we had the Clay Springs fire that I think if you remember back may be familiar with. It was a rather large fire, burned right up against the freeway, burned over 100,000 acres, and did a fantastic job of restoring some of that mountain range to sheep habitat. And so there is a lot of good unoccupied sheep habitat on there, and so we are proposing to reestablish sheep to the native range on the Oak Creeks. Within the plan, we address some issues and some concerns, as you can see listed there. There are quite a few of them. The first one on the list, the top one, is proximity of domestic sheep. There are not currently any sheep allotments on the Oak Creek unit itself, but there are two that are about 7 miles north of sheep habitat. And so we have addressed that and looked at that as an area of concern. And any sheep or wild sheep that wanders into that area, if it does happen, will be addressed according to the statewide sheep plan. It is a pretty good area that will allow for a lot of wildlife viewing. There are some trails and some hiking area that will allow people to hike up and see them. So human disturbance was an issue that we will have to address. However, I do believe that the disturbance will be cut down quite considerably because of the areas that they will go to view the sheep. You can see them quite well, but they're not going to be right on top of the sheep, and they're not in the projected lambing areas. Currently, the unit is a limited entry deer unit as well. So it is kind of a high profile area. There are a lot of people that go out to look at the deer from around the areas. And so people are aware of the human wildlife interactions out there, and it does get a lot of attention from our officers as well. Our objective and our population strategies are to manage for up to 300 Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep on the unit. We came
you know, we looked at and came up with that number by looking at historic literature. All the literature is stating that that they recommend having 1.3 to 1.9 sheep per kilometer squared. And so looking at our suitable sheep habitat and the amount that we have, we believe that it has the ability to hold up to the 300 sheep and possibly more than that. But that is our objective, is for the 300 sheep. And it will begin with an initial sheep transplant of roughly 40 to 60 sheep from in-state sources. Like I said before, we did have a fire that did help out the sheep habitat considerably. There are still some improvements and things that we can do to make sure that we maintain the sheep habitat on that, and we are looking to maintain and improve that. Some of those specifically are, even though we had a fire that opened up a lot of the area, some of the fire that we worked to get out so it didn't get out of control left the skeletons of some of the pinyon juniper area, and so we will be working to in some of those areas to remove the skeletons and make it a little bit more open and a little bit better for the sheep habitat. In our plan, we did look at different recreation and objective strategies, and with that we wanted to look at the different hunting opportunities that this may present, and that is the goal of the division, as I see it, is to bring this to a population that everybody can enjoy it, both hunters and wildlife viewers alike, that they can come in and look at that. And so at a time that the population is at a manageable level, the division will be looking at recommending a hunt consistent with the statewide management plan. And that is the long and the short of it. So I'll take any questions or clarifications that anybody has.
Any questions or points of clarification from the REC?
I'm not sure who you're working with the BLM. Were you aware that there's a lot of trailing sheep
there? Yes.
Right there in the pass?
Yeah, right there in the pass. They do trail sheep, and they go out into the West Desert, and they come from San P County, if I am...
That's the trail, yeah.
Right, and so we are working with the BLM on that and looking at possible options to maybe enhance or help them with possible trailering options. Or, you know, that is a risk that we looked at. We are aware of that and understand that that does take place.
Just making sure you knew that.
Yes.
And Fillmore would be willing to work with you on that. I'm just not sure who in Fillmore you're working with.
But. We've been working with Mace Crane.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
That, you know, there are those big sheep ranches on the north side of the Gilson.
Yes.
Right there.
So the Gilson and the shearing allotments were the sheep allotments that we talked about to the north. One of them is 7 miles north of projected sheep habitat. The other one's 5.5 miles north. The closer one holds sheep for just roughly over a month. I think their allotment's for like 33 days. The one that is further north holds it for about 6 or 7 months. So they do have the sheep there that we discussed. You know, and there could potentially be the issue with the wild sheep wandering down into that area. And as we looked at it, if that happens, we will address that according to the state sheep-wide management plan. Currently, as you see it, it is not ideal sheep habitat. It's cheatgrass and pinyon juniper. And so there is the option that they go down into there, but it's not primary that I guess it's going to draw them. Furthermore, there's a lot of barriers. The Sevier River is a barrier. There is Highway 132 that is a barrier. There is some numerous amounts of fencing from cattle that are in there. And so they would have to cross over quite a few barriers to get there. That's not saying that it is impossible or will never happen. And if and when it does happen, we will address that, like I said, according to the management plan.
Richard?
Yeah, I'd like to see it work, but I just want to make sure that it's you know, because Nebo's been an area that they've just thought and thought and thought, tried to keep them there, you know, and it's great habitat for them. But I noticed that there's a 507,000 acres of private land there. What's to keep a private landowner from raising sheep on there and going right up into that mountain? I mean, I guess you... it's just...
You bring up a good point there. I guess with their private land, they do have the potential to bring in a backyard flock, if you will. As we looked at the area and looked at the towns nearest by, there weren't currently any backyard flocks in the area. The public that I have had the opportunity to talk to understands that that is a concern, and I have talked to numerous landowners. Obviously, I won't be able to talk to them all or address every situation, but that is something we will have to be mindful of and certainly keep our eye out for.
Danny.
Yeah, from the burn, those dead trees, what do you plan on doing? Chaining that, or how are you going to knock those down? What are you going to do?
It depends on which area they are in. Some of them lean to chaining quite easily. Some of them are in areas that make it a little bit different, so a little bit tougher. So it may fall to a lop and scatter type project or different things. So it will be addressed on a case-by-case basis, but chaining certainly is an option in a few areas.
So we'll be looking for other habitat improvements from that burn, is that correct?
That is correct. And to address that even further, after the burn happened, we worked with different land management agencies and worked with the reseeding to put in seeding that would benefit all wildlife, including wild sheep.
Any other questions from the rack?
Just Larry. Going back to the sheep trail, Mike was talking about, you're trying to block off the sheep trail?
No. No, we're not trying to block off the sheep trail. That is something that we are aware of and understand the time of year that it comes through. The options that if we move to doing anything, it would be to try and make it more affordable for the rancher to trailer his sheep rather than trail them. But we would not be, we're not looking towards blocking the trail of the sheep off.
It was more affordable, they'd already be trucking them.
Right.
Those sheep trails are dedicated, and there's not very many of them left. And they are dedicated trails, and I don't think it's possible for the state or the DWR to take away a sheep trail.
No, and we're not looking to do so.
So basically what you're trying to do is just go to them and say, look, we'll help you financially, and load them in trailers and take them out the desert.
All options like that will be explored. Whether if we get the cooperation and the funds and that is, we are able to do that, that is something we're willing to look into. But that is, we are not looking to change or take away the sheep trail or stop him from any operation. We understand that that is a risk that we are going to have to be aware of and understand the time of year that it comes through and watch that closely. But we are certainly not looking to take away his sheep trail.
Okay, any other questions from the rec? Questions from the audience?
Dave, what else? Were these the sheep we're planning on moving? It's going to be this winter? If it's all approved?
If everything goes, yes.
And that was, I understand, from the Newfoundlands now?
The Newfoundlands and the Antelope Island. Justin may have a better idea on the sources of that as well.
Yeah, as it sits now, it may be both, part from Antelope Island and part from the Newfoundland Mountains, which the Newfoundland Mountain population came from Antelope Island. So,
same sheep.
Yeah, it could be both. It could be one.
Okay, great.
Any other questions from the audience? Any comments from the audience? Dave Woodhouse.
Dave Woodhouse. For myself and also representing SFW, but we're really excited about this move. It's been...
Attention, Springfield patrons. The Springfield Library is now closed. Please make your way to the front exit doors. Thank you and have a good night.
But it's been a long time in the making, and and like I say, that fire sped things up, and we kind of need another place to put the sheep, because my understanding is, like, on the Newfoundlands, they're starting to get pretty populated, and whenever the sheep populations get that dense, they start having disease problems. So that we have a place to put them and that many sheep that we need to do some movements, a good problem to have, and reflects well on our DWR and all the work they've done. So I just hope you guys can approve this and we can get it done. And as far as, you know, the conflict with the other sheep, I know there's been some discussion through FNAS and that of working with the BLM and to fix up the fence and that, to kind of mitigate the possibility of the wild sheep moving down into the range, to the area where they trail through. So I don't think that should be too big of a concern at this point. Thanks.
Thank you, Dave. Any other comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the rack. Sarah.
Can everybody hear you about using the microphone?
No.
So I can hold this. I was not asked. I was told that I needed to read this letter from the Fish Lake Forest Supervisor addressed to Dave Black, who is the Southern Region RAC Chair. So I will go ahead and read this, so bear with me. Dear Mr. Black, this letter is in reference to the Oak Creek Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep Management Plan that has been proposed to set the framework for establishing bighorn sheep in southern Utah. The Forest Service appreciates the opportunity to provide comments on this plan and proposed introduction of the bighorn sheep into southern Utah. The Forest Service has made the following observations regarding this proposed plan. First, we acknowledge that if the proposal introduction is implemented, it would occur on approximately 8% of the land administered by the Fish Lake National Forest, Fillmore Ranger District. Number two, the Fish Lake National Forest has reviewed the land and resource management plan and finds that the proposal introduction of bighorn sheep is consistent with language contained within the plan, which speaks to allowing for the establishment of desirable species on sites that can supply the habitat needs of the species. Number three, the Forest Service has determined that there are currently no sheep grazing on lands administered by the Forest Service in the Canyon Range portion of the Fillmore Ranger District. Number four, there is adequate habitat for bighorn sheep along with the cattle, deer, and elk currently grazing in the area. Based on the information above, I have concluded that approval of the Oak Creek Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep Management Plan by the Wildlife Board and introduction of bighorn sheep in the Canyon Range is not in conflict with the Fish Lake Land and Resource Management Plan, and the Forest Service supports this proposal. In closing, we appreciate the opportunity to provide comments to this proposed plan and look forward to working cooperatively with the state in the implementation phase of this project. We look forward to working with the division in the future on any needed changes to the management plan based on natural resource condition monitoring. If you have questions, please contact Ron Rodriguez. It's his number, or myself. Sincerely, Alan Rowley, Forest Supervisor. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah. Do you wish to comment on the letter?
I think it was very well written.
Okay.
And the Central Region and our forest is in favor as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other comments from the RAC?
Question to approve as presented the Oak Creek Bighorn Sheep.
Okay, motion is made by Chris to approve the proposal as presented. Is there a second? Richard seconds it. Okay, is there any discussion or question about the motion?
Seeing none, all in favor? Okay, all opposed? Okay, 9 in favor, 1 opposed, motion passes. For those of you, the board meeting that will address these issues will be December 5th at the DNR boardroom. We'd invite you to come attend to that. We appreciate you coming and showing interest, and we appreciate your comments and your suggestions. Meeting is adjourned.